episode of Bitcoin, the giant Bitcoin ETF created by those two fancy Facebook twins was squashed by the feds. Meanwhile, the disagreeing factions in Bitcoin got closer and closer to an outright war of Bitcoin forks. Will Bitcoin stay as one united currency, or will Bitcoin divide and attack itself to the point an altcoin moves into its territory as cryptocurrency boss? Stay tuned and you'll find out none of these things.
Hello, welcome to episode 43 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. This is my first two-part podcast. It wasn't intentional, but Ricardo Spagni, aka Monero's fluffy pony, talked to me for over 3.5 hours. In the previous episode, we mostly covered Ricardo's past. In today's episode, we discuss more current topics. Here we go.
I don't know how to, so I've used the bridge designer analogy before when somebody came at me and said, why does Fluffy Pony hate Ethereum? Let's take a step back and let's imagine that instead of people working on altcoins or on cryptocurrencies, we are bridge designers. And, you know, if you had to present a design for a new type of bridge, I mean, who better to criticize your design or compliment your design than somebody else who is a bridge designer? I find it fascinating could you ever imagine a scenario where, like, a mechanical engineer says, well, your bridge design won't work because obviously you're using string and spaghetti, and that's terrible materials for designing a bridge. And then, the other bridge designer turns around and says, oh, that's just FUD. You're just doing that because you're the competition. You want your bridge design to work. I mean, it's ridiculous. No one would ever do that. They'd be like, well, it's a bridge. It's going to carry human lives. And so we want the best bridge design that we can get that is also safe. And yet when it comes to cryptocurrency, suddenly people go like, they sort of throw it all out the window and they go, oh, that's just FUD. And then you say, yes, but, you know, this is serious stuff. This is people's money that we're protecting. And with privacy-enhancing projects, it's people's lives that we're defending. And they go, oh, that's rubbish. Nonsense. No one in cryptocurrency would ever invest more than they're willing to lose. You know, which is, of course, nonsensical, because we've seen posts about people wanting to commit suicide because they lost their family's life savings by investing in Bitcoin when it was at $1,200. So I sort of I take the approach of who better to criticize my work than somebody who has done work on a cryptocurrency. And I don't mean like someone who's just started. I mean someone who's done work on a cryptocurrency that's been around for a little while and has achieved some measure of usage or success. As you know, depending on how you want to measure it, and I think it's really silly to who else would you expect to criticize? You know, like Bob the Trader, he's not in a position to criticize this stuff. He doesn't understand game theory. He's not sure about the disincentives that apply in a consensus model. He has no clue what cryptography is, and you know how it applies to a cryptocurrency. Hint, it's in the word crypto. And yet, like, when Bob criticizes it, then that seems to be fine. And when an altcoin developer criticizes it, then people like go FUD.
But it is interesting for, you know, people like me who aren't technical people. I mean, I'm the technical person to my friends and my family. But once I got involved in Bitcoin, I felt like the least technical person in the room. But, you know, you'll hear whether it's scaling or is Ethereum, you know, good or bad or whatever. I mean, it's hard for me to make heads or tails sometimes of the arguments. And I have a sense of what I believe, but it certainly isn't a strong sense. So it's always hard for me to really parse, you know, is this a valid attack? Does this make sense? You know, it's hard for me to really know. So I just kind of see who seem to be knowledgeable and trustworthy and tend to give their opinions a little bit more weight, I guess.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think one of the things that as Bitcoiners, as technical Bitcoiners, I guess I'm at a point now where I can at least publicly call myself technical without feeling embarrassed doing so. As technical Bitcoiners, I feel like we have failed a bit because we haven't, you know, especially if you've been in Bitcoin for more than a couple of years, if you've been in Bitcoin for longer than the 2013 price spike, then you have a not a requirement, but responsibility really to educate the users. And I feel like we failed at that. I feel like we have users who have a very rudimentary understanding of the stuff that's involved. And it's not to say that they should view people as oracles, but definitely I think that we would be better off if people treated it like bridge design or nuclear power plants. You know, you would understand that there is only a small, relatively small group of people who understand the stuff. And newcomers who are technical are welcomed into the small group of people who understand the stuff, as long as they too understand the stuff. That's not to say that there's a lack of experimentation or a lack of playing around, but there absolutely should be rigor. And there should be a broad understanding of how cryptocurrency works. The fact that I have had to explain to altcoiners who work on cryptocurrencies older than Monero how Bitcoin works is shocking. I have no idea how they've managed to hack away at stuff for 3.5 years or over 3 years, whatever it is, and they still don't understand the basics of cryptocurrency. They still don't understand how Nakamoto consensus works. It's like beyond embarrassing, and yet they are viewed as oracles within the community.
So I'm really curious. Can you give an example of something they didn't understand and explain it so that I'll understand it, assuming I don't already?
Sure. So let's take proof of work as a classic example.
Is that a real cricket? Is that a real cricket?
A real cricket. Yes, there's one. I saw one. Yep. That flew into the garage 5 minutes ago.
I didn't know if it was a phone ringing or something. No,
no. Is it like super loud?
It's amazingly loud, to be honest, but it's fine. It adds a little ambience, but it was very clear. Yeah. Anyway, not a big deal. I just had to comment on it.
Yeah, it's, you know, 10 o'clock at night in South Africa. We have crickets.
All right.
I'd try and find it, but it's hidden behind boxes.
I was talking to someone else, and a mouse trap went off during our interview once too.
Oh, wow! Interesting.
But anyway, all right. So go ahead, explain away.
Yeah. So proof of work. Proof of work is a classic example of stuff altcoiners don't understand. Proof of work is it exists for a reason. Okay, it's this horrible, inefficient mechanism, but it exists for a reason, and that is individual nodes have no way of establishing the same state. So I've seen, as an example, cryptocurrencies that have said, we have a system for nodes to sync their mempool, you know, the memory pool of transactions, which sounds great in theory. Because, nodes sync their mempool. So we have whatever, instant transactions or whatever jazz. But the reality is that you can't sync a mempool. It's physically impossible because all you can get is a representation of a mempool from a bunch of nodes around you that you may or may not be – that you may be connected to and may actually represent the same individual person. Who knows? There is no – reason for transactions to be broadcast before they are mined. A mining pool or a miner can include a whole bunch of transactions that you've never seen before. that aren't in your mempool. So proof of work exists as a finalization, as a way of determining consensus in a way that is indelible and immutable and permanent. Now, imagine a scenario where we had magical payment channels and we were able to verify that when we ask a fellow node to do something, it gets done. Proof of work would not need to exist because we could say to a node that we're connected to, please take my transaction and broadcast it. And they would say, okay, I've broadcast it. And if we trust them in this magical scenario, in this beautiful hypothetical paradise where all the nodes we're connected to are trustworthy, we would go, well, they've broadcast it. That's great. And we'd say to another node, please broadcast my transaction. And they'd say, I broadcast it. And we'd say, thank you. Thank you for your service. And because we could in this magical paradise, confirm that the service that we are asking for has been done, maybe the service we are paying for, we would, we'd be confident that all nodes could be in sync because we could just ask all the nodes to broadcast all the transactions and every node would share state and we would have no need for a blockchain. We would have no need for proof of work because every node would know that they would get every transaction because they're paying for nodes to broadcast them. Now, the whole point of Nakamoto consensus and of proof of work is for transaction finalization, regardless of whether everyone has seen the transaction. So in the I don't know if you're familiar with the two generals problem.
Go ahead and present it.
Yeah, it's so the Byzantine generals problem is more general. Okay, the two generals problem is very specific. Now the two generals problem goes like this: it says, okay, you've got two generals from the same army. Okay, let's say that they are from the Roman army, and they are on in between these two Roman generals and their respective Roman parts of the Roman army. You have a Greek army, and now Roman General 1 needs to get a message to Roman General 2 in order to coordinate their attack. But there's no way for them to get the message to each other without going through the Greek army or going like through the Greek camp. So how do they get a message to each other in order to make sure that the plans are coordinated? You know, now you can imagine a bunch of scenarios. You can imagine, because this is obviously a thought experiment. You can imagine scenarios where they encode it. So the messenger carries a thing that says, are you coming for lunch? It's on Sunday at 12 p.m. And then the messenger carries us through and the Greek army captures him and they let him through because it's just an invitation for Sunday lunch. And meanwhile, that is the secret code. Well, you know, I mean, that's great as a thought experiment, but the reality is the Greek army wouldn't be that stupid and they would just prepare themselves on Sunday at 12 p.m. anyway. And so on it goes. You know, you start thinking about ways for all of this to happen. And this is assuming that the communication is one way, that one of the generals is the leader and decides in the time of the attack. What if the other general disagrees? And now I need to communicate back to him to say, sorry, on Sunday at 12 o'clock, I'm getting my hair cut and I can't. We can't attack the Greeks. How about next week, Thursday at 5 p.m.? I think I'm free. So that becomes a terribly difficult challenge to not only get the communication there safely, but get a response back and so on and so forth, knowing that you are going through enemy territory every time. Now, Bitcoin is designed not to solve this because Bitcoin actually doesn't solve this problem, contrary to popular belief. What it's designed to do is sidestep the problem. So it says, okay, we understand the problem exists. We understand that we're in adversarial environments. So what we're going to do is use this thing called the longest cumulative proof of work difficulty as a way of finalization. And that is absolute. And that is, you know, that it's impossible to beat because in order for you to change the message. In order for you to change the finalization, you would need to do more work than the entire network combined, which is where the whole 51% attack comes from. And so the chain with the greatest cumulative proof of work difficulty is a really powerful mechanism, because it lets, once you understand that concept and you understand Byzantine general, the two generals problem, and you understand you understand proof of work's role in all of that, then you start to understand something else, and that is, when a Bitcoin node syncs up to the network for the first time, how many, and let's say it starts off connecting to 8 nodes, how many of those 8 nodes need to be on the true network if the rest of them align for your node to sync up to the true network?
Are you what asking me? I guess one.
Yeah, I'm asking. It's only one.
I did,
and that's really powerful.
Because typically,
as humans, if you think about stuff like this, you would say, okay, we're connected to 8 nodes, so 5 of the 8 need to agree.
Yeah, you'd sure think the majority would be the ruler in that case. Yes.
And it's not. It's not the majority at all. You need one. You need the one with the greatest cumulative proof of work difficulty, because all the rest won't be able to fake that. And so these concepts are they're intrinsic. They're a part of Bitcoin, and once you understand this stuff, then understanding a lot of other stuff becomes really trivial, because it's like, oh, okay. You can intuitively decide whether or figure out whether something is valid or not, and stuff like proof of service, stuff like which Dash is trying to do, stuff like synchronizing mempools, all of these things can't possibly work. Intuitively, you know this, because the greatest cumulative proof of work is the finalization. If there was a way to finalize besides that, we would be doing it already. If there was a way to prove service, we would be doing it already. If there was a way to synchronize mempools, while we'd just be synchronizing state instead of, you know, having a horrible, unwieldy, inefficient blockchain. What's the point of a blockchain if we can do proof of service or synchronize mempools?
Ooh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it's neat. There must be a filter when you go beyond a certain volume level, then everything, including the cricket, drops out. I thought he'd stopped for a second.
Yeah, there's a when I stop talking, then the microphone cuts. That's one of those fancy things.
That damn cricket. I hate to say this, but it really is pretty loud. I don't know.
Okay, hold a sec. Let me just go and like throw a shoe at it or something.
Okay.
So I can figure it out. Wait a second. Okay.
Well, I don't hear it.
It stopped for a sec. If it starts again, just tell me and I'll throw a shoe.
You know what? So, I mean, I'll say this is a pretty long interview. So I don't know. There's so many other things I could ask you, but I'm either horrified at how long it'll be or how much time I'll be editing.
Just split it up into 4 parts, you know?
I've had that run across my brain. And it's interesting. Most people I talk to in the crypto space don't seem to want to be quite as open as you about their lives or something. Or just so I wasn't expecting you to be so interested in telling me your past. And so it's a really interesting.
Oh, no, I'm always happy to talk about. Apparently, I'm always happy to talk about myself. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm asking you. Like, if you've talked about this a lot more, I'm like wondering, will people value hearing all this? Is it unique information, or should I try?
Notice, I've only really ever spoken about like the. I mean, people know I'm married, they know about the import export stuff a bit, but I mean that's about it. It's people don't. I don't know. Like, it's weird that way. People just assume that you must come from some sort of deep technical past where you were a Unix graybeard or whatever, but that's not always the case.
I feel like you did describe a very deep technical past. You don't feel that way about yourself?
I don't know. I mean, like, I sort of like I poke away at things, and I guess I understand some stuff better than other people, but I'm definitely I mean, come on, like I've done a bunch of like event management and import export and stuff that's utterly unrelated to IT.
Well, you talk about,
I forgot even talk about me working as a waiter. I worked in a coffee shop and then worked as a waiter for a while whilst I was studying as well, and loved it because it was one of my favorite jobs because I got to speak to people all the time.
Well, I mean, I feel like you're different. I mean, not everyone's different, obviously, but it seems like a lot of developers maybe aren't quite as social as you, maybe haven't had all the waiting and the event, you know. Uh-oh, yeah. There goes the cricket, but that's okay. We'll ignore the cricket. But so anyway, that makes you, I feel like, you know, I don't know, just come off a little different than the typical programmer.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, I you know, I'm not complaining about that at all. I mean, to get back to the sort of, you know, criticizing other cryptocurrency stuff as well. I mean, like the thing that really bugs me the most about it is, I've heard this argument a lot about how experimentation is good, and I guess my answer to that always is: at what point does a cryptocurrency go from being an experiment that can take chances and fail and lose a bunch of money? At what point does it cross the threshold and suddenly become a project that needs to have rigor and needs to take extreme care in defending the money and lives of its users? Because I feel like Monero crossed that line long ago, like very long ago. And I'm probably late 2014, the minute we got attacked and we realized that we can no longer afford to staff around. And I'm constantly surprised that projects like Ethereum, that's the proponents of it, tell me that no, it's fine when Ethereum does stuff like controversial hard forks that creates an entire second version of itself. That's all fine because the thing is, Ethereum's just an experiment. And I don't understand, it blows my mind that Ethereum's just an experiment, but it's, you know, I mean, like what is it? A $1.1 billion experiment. That seems a little at odds with itself, you know.
So I guess let me ask you, what if you were to just try to give a guess, what would you guess the future of Ethereum is over the next few years?
Honestly, I think that you know, even if we put aside the various bits of brokenness that exist in Ethereum, even if we ignore that and we assume that Ethereum is incredibly well designed and all things are good, and there was no Ethereum Classic that never existed, it was just a figment in our imagination. The problem with Ethereum is that any possible use case for it is 5 to 10 years too early. We're not at a point where, I mean, it's like trusting your life to artificial intelligence. We're just simply not at that point. We're at a point where we're on the cusp of trusting self-driving cars to get us from point A to point B. But even that is really a few years away. I'm definitely, I mean, I've got an Infinity Q50S, which has a whole bunch of like self-driving features. And I'm far from trusting that thing on the road, like with my hands off. I've driven in a Volvo S92, which also has amazing self-driving features, and the Tesla doubly so, but I'm still not in a position where I'm comfortable taking my hands off the wheel. And then I look at stuff like Ethereum, where now it's sort of like several levels beyond that, where we have to trust something like a retirement annuity to a piece of code. And we need to trust that piece of code is going to run forever and be unstoppable, despite Vitalik wanting to fork the blockchain just because some people lost money. And I sort of look at that and I'm like, it's just too early. It's simply too early in this space to start doing things like that. It would be like Tesla having released a self-driving car 5 years ago. just it would never, like, no one would have trusted it. They would have gone like, no, thank you. Even if they release one today, no one would trust it. So I think that they're just too early. And even if you take, like even if you look past all the brokenness, that is the bottom line. That is the primary thing that makes Ethereum, to me, disinteresting as a project. I'm far more interested in the stuff that Bitcoin Hive Mind and Rootstock and some of those projects are doing, where they're trying to solve the problem from another angle. They're trying to say, well, what are the foundations that we need? What are the base layers we need in order for us to eventually get to a point where something like an Ethereum smart contract can exist? And you know, what are the reasons that we'd want it to exist? And I think we're just far away from it right now.
Today's magic word is Dash. D-A-S-H. By entering the magic word at letstalkbitcoin.com, you'll prove you've listened to this episode. You're a Bitcoiner, but you have the iconic Bitcoin keychain? Support this podcast and own the Bitcoin keychain you've probably seen hundreds of times on sites like CoinDesk, Bitcoin Magazine, Ars Technica, Vice, Popular Mechanics, Engadget, and many, many more. Just go to btckeychain.com, click the Buy a Keychain link at the top, and you'll find a list of retailers that includes crypto shops like Bitcoin Not Bombs and mainstream vendors like Amazon.com. That's btckeychain.com. So obviously you have projects you're not real excited about. Are there any other projects that you are excited about?
Yes. So projects that I'm excited about, I like Sia very much.
Okay, what's that?
Sia is it's like a decentralized storage project. But the difference between a lot of other projects is you can sell hard drive space. You can say, I'm willing to host a piece of data, which might be very, you know, might be something I morally disagree with, but I'm not going to know because it's encrypted. And Sia provides a foundation and a framework for contracts to exist. So you have an automated contract. Let's call it a smart contract if we really need to, between somebody who wants you to store their data and yourself. And obviously they can duplicate their data over a bunch of different endpoints by having a bunch of signing contracts electronically with a bunch of different providers, a bunch of different suppliers. Then their data is backed up and duplicated across and all of that jazz. And there's a whole bunch of there's a bunch of tricks and caveats to how Sia works, but it is the underlying stuff is very clever, and it is effectively, the simplest way to think about it is a peer-to-peer marketplace for storage, and it's designed such that if you lie about storing data, you get penalized and you lose a deposit that you've put down. And because of that, you are incentivized to store the data and to not lie about storing it. It's really put together very cleverly, and I like David Vorick very much because I think he's got a smart head on his shoulders. And I think that he's been critical of stuff that we've done in Monero. I've been critical of stuff in Sia, but the stuff that we've been critical of each other has been not underlying design problems. It's been decisions that we might do differently. For example, he thinks the fact that Monero has hard forks every 6 months is kind of scary, which is true. Absolutely, I agree with him. I think that the fact that Sia, I understand why Sia has its own token, Sia coin, because they did it at a time before there were alternatives that they could have used. I mean, it was designed relatively early on, before they had opportunity to bolt on top of Bitcoin and do a bunch of other stuff. And so I understand why it existed, and yet that's still a criticism of mine that they have to have their own token instead of doing it, you know, through Bitcoin. And so we, you know, the criticisms that we have of each other's projects are not underlying criticisms. They're not criticisms where we're like, well, this is such a major issue that it would prevent me from using that person's project. Sia is still in its infancy, just like Monero is, and it still has a lot of maturing to do. But I'm quite impressed with the direction that they're going as a community and as a project.
Can I say one thing?
Yes.
Sure, it's always so sad that I guess just anyone listening to someone talk about a project, even when it was Joseph talking about Monero a couple of years ago, all my head goes, but he probably has some of their coin and maybe he wants to pump it a bit. Who knows? Is it really better than storage? It's sad that that has to be part of the thing.
But. I agree. And like with anything, I encourage people to read up on it. On Sia's website, they have there's a really good post on Sia versus storage and Sia versus MadeSafe. Now, MadeSafe, I don't think bears any discussion because, honestly, if they can't get their stuff together after a decade, they need to just like pack it up and go home. And there are other criticisms I haven't made safe that are technical, but let's just put that aside. But storage versus Sia is a worthy discussion. And there is a very, very interesting thread on the Sia forum where David Vorek presents a bunch of reasons why he thinks Sia is superior to storage. And then Sean Wilkinson pops in and you know, they sort of have a great big back and forth.
That sounds fun.
And it's worth reading. There are parts where it gets pretty heavy, but for the most part, I guess some people who are maybe not massively technically inclined might walk away from reading that thread with, well, I don't actually know what to believe. But as a technical person reading through that thread, that was one of the things that convinced me that. That David Vorek has a good head on his shoulders and that Sia is a project that I am watching with keen interest. Yes, I do own a little bit of Sia. I can't even remember how much I bought. I own a little bit of everything. I have a recommendation, I guess, which is always buy $100 of every scam. And it started with me buying $100 of Tenebrix and then $100 of Fairbrix. And then $100 of Litecoin right at the beginning.
Did you buy $100 of Ether?
I did, yes. I still have them. I sold a little bit at the top, but like about a third. I sold the rest of it. I have my Ethereum Classic. I have Ripple. I sold a bunch of Ripple at the top as well.
So can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
Where do you keep all these coins? You don't run every client, right? Or do you?
I try to do cold wallets for everything because I have a tendency to forget about them, like forget that they exist, which sometimes has been to my detriment because then there's like a massive pump and I'm like scrabbling to go find the cold wallet and then scrabbling to sync up on the client to sweep it. But at the end of the day, it's one of those things. It's like I sort of I tend to focus on two sell levels with my $100. I sell between 50% and 70% of it when it's worth 10 times the value I bought in, so that I make back my $100 and then some. And then the remaining sort of 30, 40, sometimes even 50%, I sell if it hits 100 times its value. That happens very rarely.
Yeah,
but when it does happen,
when has that happened for you? The 100.
It happened with Litecoin. It happened with a couple of pumps. But I mean, you know, you turn $100 if you're quick enough, especially if it's like on a pump. You can turn $100 into $10,000, just because you know some altcoin scammers want to pump their bag hold. You know, like it's one of those things.
So do you have automated something automated telling you at these thresholds, or are you having to?
No, some of the stuff I'm just super lazy with, and so I try and buy from miners. I used to. I've become really lazy recently, and I just buy when it's on an exchange. Uh-huh. I try buying like the first exchange, because like if it goes on. You know, some of these altcoins go on Bittrex, as an example, and they're on Bittrex for a little while, and then they'll eventually go on Poloniex. And you know, if you can, like, if I'm buying on Bittrex, not on day one, but on like, you know, day whatever, where it's at least calmed down a bit, then I'm still way below what it's going to hit on Poloniex. But I mean, that's just like the paint splatter thing, you know? I mean, you're throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And then I end up with like a bunch of scam coins on Poloniex that I own $100 of them, and I just set the sell levels and walk away. And I have a little ticker in my menu bar, which shows me my Bitcoin balance on Poloniex. And like some days I'll wake up and like my Bitcoin balance will be 7 Bitcoin, and I'll be like, cool, what happened? You know, like.
maybe you should be a fund manager for altcoins or something.
You know, honestly, the liquidity is so low that I don't think I could do this with more than $100 of each scam coin.
There you go.
There've been times when I go look at the trade history afterwards, and it's like, you know, it maybe blew through $4,000 in volume at my sell level, and then tanked back down, you know. I mean, some of these are like the volume, the liquidity is ridiculously low.
I had no idea you were so involved in just all these random coin kind of speculating. That's crazy.
Oh yeah, I got burnt on Tenebrix and Fabrix because I was super excited about them, and that's when I came up with the whole like buy $100 of every scam thing. It was just purely as a reaction to that, because I ended up bag holding Fabrix. You know, much to my great dismay. I mean, I made it up quite nicely and quite handily with Litecoin. But yeah, I mean, at the time, I was not a happy camper.
I accepted a bunch of Litecoin when it was like $30+ each and held it. And that didn't turn out well. So hey, you mentioned, and I guess I'd heard this before, that you fork every 6 months with Monero.
Yes.
How does that usually go?
Well, so far we haven't created Monero Classic or Monero XT, so I guess that's a positive sign.
And how has that not happened?
So I guess that there are a couple of things. The first is because we fork every 6 months. Well, the reason we fork every 6 months is probably more important. The reason we fork every 6 months is because it's impossible to know the people that are running nodes. If we could know the people that are running nodes, well, again, we're back to that whole thing of why do we have proof of work and decentralization in the first place? We don't know who run nodes. And so we can't communicate with them and say, hey, buddy, like we want to add this feature and like we need you to upgrade. All we can do is hope that they upgrade. And that's kind of bad for, well, at least in our mind, it's bad for security software that does tend to rely on people running reasonably current versions of the software for their own protection. At the same time, we're also very cognizant of the fact that if that upgrade that we push out to the network or push out to everyone includes something that is controversial, but I mean properly controversial, then we will end up with a Monero Classic Monero scenario. So we're sort of always playing this or towing this line between please let's upgrade for security reasons, and also BT dubs, nothing in here is controversial. You can check because everyone said so. And despite that, we still have had things where people have complained, and I mean a very small group of people, but we've had a handful of people complaining, and by a handful, I mean like four, about the size of RingCT transactions. And they're like, oh, RingCT transactions are so big. Monero used to be small and lean and now the transactions are massive. To which our answer was, well, RingCT's been live on testnet for months and months and months and months. We've had testnet explorers. We've had, you know, all sorts of – we've written about the increased size in RingCT transactions. How have you not been paying attention? But by and large, the community is reasonably happy for an improvement like that that improves privacy. If we were to make a change or try and make a change that is controversial, I would fully expect the community to splinter. And so the hard fork stuff is really just, what are the uncontroversial changes? What are the changes that we have loose consensus on that the community by and large is happy with? And so we sort of tread carefully, and I don't just mean like us as a core team. I mean us as a group of contributors, of several hundred contributors. We're very careful when we suggest things and when we decide we want to do stuff. Stupid cricket. Hold on. Anyway. We've just got to stay prudent with it, and we've got to keep pushing the community for their views and things.
I mean, nowadays I just almost expect a fork as like kind of a troll move. And like, now I'm going to ask you, well, what you like Ethereum Classic? I guess I could understand some people believe in Ethereum and didn't want to see the fork to roll back the DAO hack, but I also just wonder how many of those people are just kind of being trolls. I mean, what do you have? What's your sense with Ethereum Classic?
Oh yeah, I think there's been a lot of trolling. I definitely don't think that. I don't think that all of it has been this massive group of people who are altruistic and want Ethereum to stay immutable. That's sort of the gut feeling I get. I don't think that there is, the Ethereum Classic thing is kind of interesting because it's a little bit disappointing how things went down. Not so much from the proponents of Ethereum Classic, because I do think that there are some people, and I was definitely one of them, who felt that the whole fork was terribly handled. And that definitely gives you some reason to do something like Ethereum Classic. The larger issue there is over and above all of that, like the mess of the fork and all that, you've got people like Barry Silbert who are pumping Ethereum Classic. And you got to look at that and you got to sort of go, well, that's unusual.
Yeah, I agree. You know what I mean? I would never expect that.
Right. It's like, is he pumping Ethereum Classic because he believes in he genuinely believes that Ethereum is the future, but Ethereum obviously just didn't live up to his expectations. I mean, that doesn't make sense, because if that was the case, then he would be involved in Ethereum from the beginning and he would have just been a vocal, vocal opposer of the hard fork. To suddenly pitch up and be like, you know, oh, I believe in Ethereum Classic. I mean, I did a little bit of bandwagoning at the beginning too, with Ethereum Classic. I even joined the Slack for 5 minutes. But I quickly realized that they're basically just going to keep going down the Ethereum road with minimal changes. So they're not solving the underlying problems that Ethereum has, which makes it completely not at all interesting to me. And I can't imagine that Barry Silbert suddenly woke up one day and went, Ethereum. I need Ethereum in my life. Ethereum is the thing that is going to solve the world's problems. World hunger, world peace, all of the things that start with the word world. Except it needs to be immutable. And so therefore Ethereum Classic is the way forward. I can't envision that. And so it seems like this gigantic rich guy troll, like from his perspective anyway.
Okay. I'm glad to see smart people aren't totally different than me as far as evaluating that. That's my take too, I guess. man, so many things.
Oh, and yeah. by the way, I mean, like, right at the beginning when the Ethereum Classic thing was happening, I did ping some of the guys who were trying to do, like, you know, maybe we must fork Ethereum. And I said to them, well, look, if you're interested in going down the smart contract road, there have been some interesting papers on ways to do private smart contracts. And would you be interested in looking at building this out on Monero? We have a crowdfunding system, and you know, you could just instead of mucking around with this with another version of Ethereum that still has the same underlying problems, what if you did this? And some of them were like, oh yes, that sounds like a great idea, and then they just did Ethereum Classic. So that's kind of disappointing. It's like. And that speaks volumes for, you know, what is their real reason for doing it? Is there a real reason because they want immutable code that runs regardless of what governments and organizations ever dictate? Or are they doing it because they think that they can pump their bag of Ethereum into another Ethereum?
Yeah, I don't know. You feel done on that one? Said your piece
on the Ethereum. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I can really rant on Ethereum Classic.
No, I'm not looking for it. I didn't want to interrupt you.
No. I do want to point out that I do think that Ethereum Classic is significantly better than Ethereum because at least they're looking at stopping this idiotic difficulty bomb.
Hmm. I haven't kept up on the plan and the proof of stake change and all that, but
idiotic. But yeah, basically, like, I look at that and I'm like, well, at least they're doing that. It would be lol-tastic to me if Ethereum Classic ended up growing and gaining a higher market cap than Ethereum. But that's just because I'm a gigantic troll. That's not like the technical Ricardo talking. That's troll Ricardo talking.
Okay, there you go. You're pretty clearly in favor of the core team in SegWit. Is that correct? Am I remembering or not?
No, I am. Look, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm happy to discuss. Areas where I feel Bitcoin Core have made mistakes, and I mean they're definitely happy to discuss areas where they think we've made mistakes and so on. But I think by and large, Bitcoin Core as an entity, as a group of contributors and developers, have spent many years, some many more years than others, building up this thing that has a $16 billion market cap. In other words, they're responsible for $16 billion of other people's money. And the fact that they haven't screwed up is testament to their abilities. And I find it frustrating that as a group of contributors, their abilities get sidelined in favor of a bunch of other hooligans who've been around for a year or two or maybe three at the most.
So while I can generally see your point, I think the one outlier to that is Gavin Andreessen. What's your take on him? Not that he's saying a lot lately, but
so my take on Gavin is okay. So, I mean, like, you've got a couple of guys. I mean, you got Mike Hearn, you got Gavin, and you've got Jeff Garzik. You know, who've all sort of like gone down the sort of side path, for want of a better term. I mean, to some degree, maybe they're a little bit like altcoin developers that thought they understood more than they did. But maybe also, and you know, this is, I guess, to some degree, a little bit tinfoil hat-ish. But maybe, possibly, Gavin had a reason to discredit himself. And maybe he wanted to discredit himself for, you know, because he was being compelled to do something. And so all of this going down the Craig Wright road and all of that has been a way of discrediting himself, knowingly discrediting himself, rather than being compelled to do something that he didn't want to do. Again, I mean, it is tinfoil hat-ish, and I'm definitely not saying that this is absolutely the case, but that's just one theory that's crossed my mind, because I do kind of like to think that someone like Gavin should know better.
What would the theoretical or a theoretical thing he'd be compelled to do if he didn't discredit himself?
Well, I don't know. What if he was being compelled to slip back doors into Bitcoin, as an example? I don't know. Or to push blacklists or whatever. I mean, Mike Hearn wanted to push blacklists. What if Gavin was being compelled to go along with the same scheme, and he realized that, you know, this is a way of introducing control and influence, and so he had to discredit himself.
So when you say compelled, there was some leverage someone could hold against him to do these things? I mean, is that?
Well, you know, I mean, let's just to sort of like back up a second. Let's not forget that back in the day, Gavin was invited to go talk to the CIA about Bitcoin, and that was the time at which Satoshi disappeared shortly thereafter. So you know, this was really early on. It was April 2011. April 2011, Gavin went to go visit the CIA. He was invited to speak at the CIA about emerging technologies at a conference. I don't think that he was invited and dragged into a room and waterboarded. I think it was, you know, generally was a conference that he was invited to go talk at, and he spoke about Bitcoin. That said, it was April 2011. It's not like it was 2013 and there was a price run-up and the CIA suddenly woke up. So you kind of look at that and you're like, that's unusual. And shortly thereafter, Satoshi disappeared and stopped posting on Bitcoin Talk. So, you know, you sort of have to look at that. I guess he was a little bit nervous. Whatever the case is, you know, he'd stopped posting on Bitcoin Talk by that point already, because he hadn't logged in. The last time he logged into Bitcoin Talk, I think, was end of 2010. But they were, you know, he was still active elsewhere, and like shortly after Gavin's CIA visit, he stopped. Whether that was due to nervousness or some planned event, who knows? But it does surprise me that somebody that has been around for that long would suddenly start doing all sorts of weird stuff, like the whole, you know, Craig Wright is Satoshi, and he proved it to me by giving me a laptop that obviously was totally brand new, clearly, and making me check some stuff which was not checking stuff at all. That whole thing was super weird. Whether Craig Wright was involved with, you know, the people that created Bitcoin or not, in my mind, is largely irrelevant, because the whole sort of proof of him being Satoshi was just super weird and super weirdly conducted.
Did he really go into detail about that? I didn't know he really went into detail how that worked, what the proof was.
He went down the road of, like, I think he had a whole blog post and everything on it. And then he backed up off it and said that it was a mistake, you know, that to say that. He said, if I recall correctly, because remember that Craig Wright put that blog post up where he wrote a whole bunch of stuff. He stole and reposted a whole bunch of stuff about how signing in Bitcoin works. And that blog post was super weird. And then Gavin, after that blog post, put up a or said that he's still convinced that Craig Wright is Satoshi. And he said that there was proof shown to him privately, that he sort of insinuated whether it is like if it's exactly how it played out, but he asked Craig Wright to sign one of the early Bitcoin blocks with Gavin's with a key that Gavin provided, and then he was given a new laptop, like a clean laptop, and he checked it on that laptop. But he didn't buy the laptop. The laptop was provided by Craig and his buddies. So, I mean, the whole thing was just super weird. Oh, man. There's a wide article on it that you need to read. It's like there's like two wide articles like within a row. The whole thing is just super weird. I mean, like at the end of the day, again, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter if it's true or not. It doesn't matter if he is part of the group that created Satoshi or is Satoshi himself. Whatever the case is, nothing in that situation was clean. Gavin said he was Satoshi, but the proof was really weird and he used his laptop to check and on and this new laptop and it's so confusing. And then he backed off and said it was a mistake to say he was Satoshi. Everything's just weird. And I sort of looked at that and I went, well, when do people get weird? Well, I know when I get weird. I get weird, like, you know, as a kid, I used to get weird when my mom said, have you brushed your teeth? And I was sitting on my computer and I didn't want to go brush my teeth. And I was like, yes. And then my mom would say, like, well, I'm in the bathroom and checking and your toothbrush is dry. And I'd be like, crap.
Damn, we got busted for the same things a lot of times.
I'd be like, yes, mom, like, I brushed my teeth, like, after supper. That was like 4 hours ago. You know, toothbrush is dry. It's very warm night, not that humid. It's very dry up here on the Highveld. Things happen. Toothbrushes are dry. It's just, you know, I brush my teeth. Don't worry about it. And sort of like I would have these stupid excuses that made no sense, and I'd have to like do a song and dance around it. And meanwhile, the reality was that the truth was much simpler. And I look at this and I'm sort of like, well, Gavin's story is this weird convoluted, it makes no sense, and now I'm doubling back and he has this weird thing about it and now it is and it isn't. And why does somebody create – why is this mess created? The mess is created around it because the truth is much simpler, but we just don't know what it is. And you know, whether the truth is that he is Satoshi or whether the truth is that tinfoil hats on – Gavin has been asked to do something naughty by some government agency, and so he needed to discredit himself. I don't really care. The reality is that either way, Gavin has gotten to a point where I can't trust him as an oracle. I can't trust him as somebody who is presenting Bitcoin's best interests because of the weird mess around it. It's the same as Jeff Garzik. I think Jeff's a great guy. But Jeff's entire tune has changed from – you look at his tweets from a year or two ago where he clearly understood the block size debate, where he clearly understood the position that Bitcoin needed to take with respect to hard forks, with respect to its openness to change, all of that. He understood all of this, and yet now his tweets more recently have become more – I mean, it's sort of one step away from him saying, I support Bitcoin Uncensored. Bitcoin Uncensored. I support Bitcoin Unlimited. And
you always got to get Bitcoin Uncensored every time you're on the show.
I'm sorry. I was trying to pump it.
It's interesting too because I heard him speak at a conference here in L.A. And I kind of have the same read that – it's kind of gone that way.
I am very loath to put tinfoil hats on. I normally tend to go the opposite and just call a spade a spade and just write someone off as a scammer, like, sooner rather than later. If they redeem themselves later on, great, but you know, normally they don't. And yet I'm sort of like like looking at this and thinking to myself, maybe this is tinfoil hat time. Maybe this is weird enough to pop the tinfoil hat on. I don't know.
Well, that's interesting. You have me thinking that way a little more now. I hadn't really thought about everybody, but gosh, there must be a lot of weird secrets and pressures and all kinds of stuff that we can't imagine, or I can't.
Oh, yeah.
So as we've been talking, just for fun, I've been refreshing CoinMarketCap.com and watching you kind of trade places for fourth with Litecoin since we've been talking, and now it looks like Litecoin's back up to fourth. But so you say, I mean, you're not the president of Monero, like the president of Bitcoin.
No, what I am actually is the CEO, the chief entertainment officer.
Oh, there we go. Okay. I mean, you are the only person I'm familiar with as far, and obviously I'm not a Monero person, but as representing Monero, you, at the beginning of our interview, were kind of downplaying. I don't know if you're just very kind to everybody else, or, I mean, you're not kind of the main Monero guy. Is that, you're not?
No, I kick merge and pull requests. You know, that's kind of my main role. But I mean, like, how do you measure main? You know, like that's the real question. If we're going to measure main by talks at a bunch of conferences, then yes, I'm the main Monero guy. I am the conference talker. You need me at a conference, I'm there. I will do a talk, whether it is 20 minutes or 2 hours. I have slides for everything. Whether if you're talking about the person that merges pull requests that the community says he must merge, I'm that guy too. But the community tells me what to merge, so I could be a robot and I would be able to perform the same function. If you're talking about the guy that writes source code, I'm not that guy.
Who is that guy?
There's over 200 contributors.
Well, okay, but I mean, it seems like there's some bigger contributors in Bitcoin. I mean, are there some bigger contributors in Monero?
Oh, absolutely. So if you go to openhub.net/p/Monero, that gives you an overview of all the Monero projects. So not just the CLI, not just Kavri, our I2P router, not just the GUI. It gives you a cross-section of every single Monero project. And you can break it. You can view the contributors, and I can tell you right now the top contributors. Okay, so I'm at the top because I merge a bunch of code. Okay, and I've written a little bit of code, but mostly because I have a bunch of merge commits. And then the top two contributors beyond me are Anonymal, who works almost exclusively on Kavri, and Monero Moo, who works almost exclusively on the Monero command line tools. And that's by that's broken down by commits. You know, but there are so many contributors, like Howard Chu, for example, who only has 107 commits over all time. But those commits are so potent and so full of like of worth that, you know, I would never take his contribution and view it as less important than Monero Moo, who is like an animal that just pushes out code left, right, and center. The same on the I2P Kavri side, Ian Embite, who is he's only got 202 commits to his name versus Anonymous nearly 900. But Ian Embite's commits are they just represent a very deep understanding of the I2P protocol and of Kavri as a project. So, you know, you sort of have to look at that and you have to say, like, is a contributor's worth based on the number of commits? Because I'm sitting on 2,051 commits, but 99% of those are me merging other people's pull requests. So they don't actually count at all. If you had to take my non-merge pull requests, I'm sitting somewhere down the bottom.
Okay. Why am I even talking to you? No, I'm just kidding.
I know, right? Yeah. I can recommend a whole bunch of other people that just don't want to go in podcasts.
Got it. Well, that's probably the sign of a good programmer. That they're not as good at coming up.
He doesn't want to go to podcasts.
I guess. I don't know. Okay. Maybe I'm losing it after 3 hours here. We have.
No, it's yeah. You know, I mean, my main role within the Monero project is testing, reviewing, and merging pull requests. And I mean that you know, like I won't undersell myself. It does take a certain amount of wherewithal and knowledge to do that. But I mean, at the end of the day, the people that are doing the real work, the people that are writing the code that I end up reviewing and testing, it's not me. You know, I can provide input and I can help people like figure out how best to do something and how to architect something. But again, even there, I'm not the only person with a good idea. I'm not the only person with knowledge of systems architecture and decentralized systems, or decentralized security software. We have an extremely strong group of contributors. And I think it's, the reason I keep sort of pointing back to them is because of the fact that they are so strong and that it would be unfair to them to undersell their contributions to the Monero project.
I'd like to think you were the main guy, because I could just like ask you what it feels like when Monero is, you know, one of the top 4 or 5 cryptocurrencies. I mean, that must feel pretty damn good.
Yeah.
I mean, look, if market cap has any meaning.
It doesn't really. I guess this, okay. So I mean, like outside of, you know, with Monero itself, the things that I value are we getting more contributors on a regular basis? Are we getting more commits to the code on a regular basis? Are we, you know, are topics on Reddit getting interesting responses? Is the Monero Stack Exchange getting answers to the questions people are asking? So I look at those as indicators of success of Monero as a project. As personal indicators of success, I have become more interested, recently at least, in my own social capital that I didn't know that I was building. So I'm very interested in stuff like, are people listening when I talk about how Zcash is centralized and Ethereum has got major design issues? Or, you know, or are they writing it off as fat? Because the minute I have enough social capital that my opinion can transcend accusations of FUD, then I need to, well, I mean, I already am extremely careful about the stuff I say, but then I have to be even more careful because, you know, I could genuinely make or break a project that is trying, but it's just misguided. And I think it can be hard to identify the difference between a project that is genuinely scammy and a project that is trying but misguided.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I guess it's a continuum when you reach that point of having that much social capital that have those type of effects.
Yeah.
If people don't know about Monero, where do they go? Where do they follow you in social media?
If they want to know about Monero, then getmonero.org is the only website. Other websites that have the word Monero in them may or may not be giving you malware that they will use to steal your wallet later on. So if it's not getmonero.org, it's not Monero. Beyond that, the Stack Exchange is fantastic. Monero.stackexchange.com. What else? The subreddit has actually more recently become a bit of a haven of interesting dialogue and discussion. So I recommend those. And then, you know, of course, IRC, we also have a Slack and Telegram relays, and then Matrix relays if people don't like IRC as an interface. As for me personally, I am on the Twitters. I'm Fluffy Pony ZA or Fluffy Pony ZA if you're in South Africa, on Twitter. And the ZA stands for South Africa, for Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek. And yeah, I tweet now and then, occasionally, every day, who knows. And I mostly troll, so if I insult you or anyone else who adds me on Twitter, I'm not insulting you to be mean. I'm insulting you because I'm a gigantic troll. So take that as it may.
All right, you rabid fluffy pony fans, was that enough for you? Typically, I edit my interviews down a ton, trying to keep it tight and professional sounding. However, this interview was barely edited. For regular listeners, do you prefer the typical highly edited interviews or this much less edited episode? Please let me know by leaving me feedback on this episode's show notes page or tweet me at TheBTCGame. I'll be giving away a Bitcoin keychain to someone who responds. You'll find this and all my episodes at TheBTCGame.com. See you next time. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. That was long. There were points where I just like spoke and spoke and spoke and you...
said nothing?
Yeah, you said nothing. And I was like, oh crap, I'm talking a lot.